yeah.
Well, part of the reason you were asked to come as close as you can to the speaker, by the speaker herself, actually, not only by me, but it's because I'd like us collectively, as a sort of mini community, which we're creating in this situation, to invite Akashti, to invite her to speak to us this afternoon. So I'd like you to have this feeling of welcoming Akashti, and a feeling as though you're requesting her to speak to you. Oh God, I forgot to bring my glasses. I can't read what I have so in my notes. But however, I'll have to ad-lib. The kind of thing I wanted to say was that Akashti is going to speak about truth and beauty, because that's the theme for the festival. But the actual title of her talk is... I'm slightly confused because the way it was billed outside was different for a while from what it actually says on the talk. And
it's not the thing that has the title of the talk.
Okay. So what's the title of your talk? Just remind me.
Following the Muse, Transforming Muse, Views.
So, that's right, Following the Muse, Transforming Views. And outside on the billboard, for a while it said, Following the Muse, Transforming Vice. because they missed out the W in the Views. And I don't know if there's any connection, but there probably is some connection, rather, because I think there is quite a connection between our vices and our views. Maybe Akashti is going to make that connection. But the kind of thing I really meant to say about Akashti is that it's just how much I appreciate her capacity to deliver truth. She has a particular quality of communication, certainly one-to-one, but I think probably you'll pick it up as well, particular quality of truthfulness. It's a very heartfelt quality of truthfulness, and I think it comes from her practice, her Mandragosha practice. Again, we were going to start with the Mandragosha mantra, but it didn't quite seem to be right with what's happening in the other tent over there. So you can maybe imagine the influence of Mandragosha, the Bodhisattva of communication and wisdom, sort of maybe flowing through Akashti as she speaks. Akashti's been coming along to Buddhafield at least as long as I have, since the mid-90s probably. She's a real Buddhafield elder, and if I may say so. And she's had tremendous impact on not only the women's side of things, but also the men's side. The whole of Buddhafield, actually, I think, has been inspired by your influence. She's about to go off and do something a bit different, but I don't think her connection with Buddhafield will be completely snapped, as it were. I think she's going to continue to be an inspiring influence on Buddhafield. Anyway, I'd like you to listen to what she has to say, and in your listening, invite her to speak to you individually. Okay?
Thank you, Kamala Sheila. Is this okay? Okay, right. Yes, as Kamala Sheila was saying, had an idea to start with some chanting, and then there was just this beautiful music in the next tent. So in some ways that fits very well. I just wanted to begin by invoking Mandragosha. Mandragosha is the Buddhist archetypal bodhisattva, who there's a representation out there in the middle of the Dharmapala area. And when we're ordained in the Western Buddhist Order, we take on most people take on a particular visualization practice, and Mandragosha is the one that took me on. It definitely felt that way around. And Mandragosha is traditionally invoked when one wants to do anything like a sort of creative, anything to do with communication, communicating meaning and truth. Mandragosha's there. He's the kind of patron deity of poetry and the arts and teaching in general and communicating the Dharma in particular. So I'll just invoke in words. And when I was, like Loka Bandhu mentioned this in the previous talk, I was asked to give a title a while ago, and you know, I kind of came up with something, and I was thinking this word, the muse, came up, and I want to talk about nature. I want to talk about Buddhafield, actually. I want to celebrate Buddhafield. And I think Buddhafield, for me, is a muse, a source of continuous inspiration, sort of unexpected, unknowable, always sort of more than you thought it was. You know, inexhaustible treasure that Buddhafield is. And so that's part of the muse, and I also would like to talk about nature as a source of inspiration and teaching. And I would like to do that using, to some extent using poetry. And as I say, Mandragosha is very connected with poetry. So that's the sort of muse aspect of the talk. Mandragosha, by the way, apparently, I mean, I'm not an academic or whatever, but is very similar to a figure in our tradition, Apollo. And Apollo has a retinue of 9 muses who are, basically, they're the sources of inspiration when we want to connect with something creative, and they include, there's a whole bunch of them, all different types of poetry. I mean, the Greeks obviously really valued poetry and music as well, and theatre and so on. So, Mandragosha. So yes, I'd like to start by, you know, there's this word truth, and in our title of our theme this year, and I found myself thinking about the difference between literal truth and poetic, what we could call poetic truth. So literal truth is the sort of realm of just fact, you know, is that accurate or not? You know, I had muesli for breakfast this morning, you know, literal truth. I didn't have porridge. So literal truth is obviously very important. It's important that we are, you know, that we just know the sort of basic facts, and, you know, and that we don't sort of twist those facts. I'm sure you can think of lots of examples where, you know, we slightly twist what we know to be just plainly true. So something about sticking to literal truth is important, but it's not enough. Literal truth is not enough to communicate deeper value and meaning. And I was remembering an experience I had. There may be a few people here who've been to a retreat centre, Taraloka. It's mostly a women's retreat centre up in Shropshire, and there's a long track. And I think probably like many other people, I've had kind of things have come to me whilst walking on that track at Taraloka. And I remember many years ago, a long, long time ago, I was on a meditation retreat. And it was, I think it was maybe the second more intensive meditation retreat I'd been on. And I felt I kind of entered unknown territory. I entered a different sort of realm that was not familiar to me, and that I did not have a clue how to express. And I can't remember, there must have been some occasion where I was called upon to sort of say how I was getting on with the meditation and so on, and I felt completely tongue-tied, and whatever I tried to say about my experience just didn't feel right. It felt like it narrowed it down, or it just wasn't quite accurate or something. And I was kind of struggling with this because I felt a bit locked into myself, like I wanted to be able to communicate the experience I was having, and I couldn't. So I felt a bit frustrated, and then I had had this dawning awareness on the track, ah, this is what poetry is for. It was just like this little opening of there are ways of using words to communicate something that actually kind of goes beyond words as we normally use them, because poetry leads into sort of metaphor and something a bit more mysterious. It leads us into a different kind of territory that's beyond literal truth. So I think I want to kind of, I'll see how I get on with this talk, but I think I want to sort of base this in the kind of poetic sphere as much as possible. In the same way that something like, the example that always comes to mind for me is the Shakespeare play, King Lear, which I just love this play, and there's something about wholeness. Shakespeare sort of, he lays out this spectrum of characters from really unspeakably cruel, nasty, vindictive individuals, and through various kinds of shades of sort of, whatever, moral uprightness or not. And then there are characters who are extraordinarily, selfless and wise and, other regarding and compassionate and so on. And then there's this whole sort of range in between. King Lear's kind of somewhere in the middle. He's a bit deluded, you know. And there's something about this play that it kind of lays out the possibilities of being human. You know, these are the different sort of choices we can make. You know, we could be Kent, who's just this totally loyal, honest friend to King Lear, even though King Lear sort of sends him away, or whatever. And so, obviously, King Lear didn't really exist. So this is not the level of literal truth. It's a story, but in a way, there's a deeper truth in there. So that's what I want to draw on that more poetic truth. and as I said, I'd like to really celebrate my time with Butterfield. Suddenly feel a bit toned up because I'm kind of leaving. I've got one more event. I've been financially supported by Butterfield for the last few years, and I've been part of the retreat team for 8 years, I think. And I'm sort of moving on from that. And so it's natural when you're kind of going into you're going out of one phase into a new phase to sort of look back. And so there's some process happening for me of kind of, well, what has this been about? And so I think that's a little bit what I want to try and bring into this talk if I can. I am following my muse, though. I'm not just going back to Babylon, as someone was at lunchtime was suggesting, I hope. See if I can stay connected. And I'm hoping to sort of put together a book based on Dharma teachings from Butterfield and partly from the Dharmapala here. So watch this space. Not from me particularly, but from lots of different people. So that's the next thing. So I guess Butterfield is many, many things, and I couldn't begin to try and encompass a sort of celebration of Butterfield here, but I think there's something that I particularly want to bring out and follows on very well. I don't know if any of you heard Lakabandhu's talk earlier. It follows on very much from what he was talking about. The theme of practicing within nature. And, I'm part of the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, which has been a largely urban-based Buddhist movement. Most people in this country, probably most people in the world, I don't know the statistics, live in cities. And so Butterfield, obviously, is not the only context, but there's something about camping, and there's something about actually arriving in a place that is just, the grass and the trees and whatever lives there already, and creating this space in which we have a retreat, and then putting it all back as faithfully as possible at the end and trying to kind of leave no traces, which is quite hard to do actually, but we try. There's something very, very special about that, which I would like to celebrate, and I'd like to celebrate all the people who are doing some version of that, practicing in a context that is closer to the elements and that is in a simpler environment. So I was thinking about my time with Butterfield, and I guess I feel, I mean, I've done lots of meditation practice, I've been on retreats and so on, which have all had a strong effect, but I think the things that really stand out for me are experiences are a kind of deeper seeing of the elemental world around. And so I started, you know, I become sort of interested in the whole sphere of kind of shamanic practice, which is seems to be, as I understand it, seems to be about opening to receive teachings from nature, from other kinds of living beings, you know, that it's a bit, there's a bit from this Wordsworth. Yeah, when people quote poetry, I often feel, I didn't quite get that, and can I see the book? And so I thought I'd hand this out, so share with someone if you want to. But there's this Wordsworth. I mean, the romantic poets are very good on this stuff. The experience of unknown modes of being. He's talking about this experience. He steals a boat in the middle of the night and he rows out onto the lake, and then this huge, mighty cliff sort of rears it. I mean, he obviously expresses it all very well. Rears up, and he just experiences this as a kind of living presence. And there's this thing, huge and mighty forms that do not live like living men, moved slowly through my mind by day and were the trouble of my dreams. So there's this, he's describing a kind of communication that he has with this mountain. He's describing something that he is affected by, and he experiences that, you know, it doesn't live like living men, but it has its life. And you know, they talk about the sublime and so on. And everybody has these experiences. We all, because this is part of the nature of reality, and the things that we look at, you know, we see a tree, oh, it's a tree, you know, and we caught up with something so we don't really notice. But we all have those experiences where actually we take something in a deeper, in a different way. And it has a flavour, it's magical. There's a kind of presence in that I think is just, you know, you read these things and we all recognize what that is. I was thinking there was a time when I was on a solitary retreat at somewhere called Rivendell, and I came eye to eye with a stag in, you know, this is just out in Sussex, in sort of posh houses and everything and bits of woodland, and there was a stag was wandering about, maybe just the distance, the other end of this tent. And suddenly he was there, I was here, and our eyes met. And we just, you know, it's that experience of this other kind of life that holds a different bit of the jigsaw. You know, it's not, it's like we humans, we spend a lot of time on our own bit of the jigsaw puzzle. And to use that metaphor, there's all these other living energies, living beings, living creatures, that hold like a different part of reality. And that seems to be what genuine shamanism is about. Is about tuning in with those other ways of being alive that are different, that are unknown, that lead us out of our little world of our little concerns, or even our big world and our big human concerns, but there's something that we are part of that we miss. And I think particularly those of us who live in cities, I mean, this, for me, travelling in between living in a city and then coming back to Butterfield, you know, living by a brook under a tree for a month, going back into town, back into a house, you know, back into sort of human culture with all its concerns. And it's like the human chatter is so pervasive. It's so loud a lot of the time. But you know, it's like the human voices are, we're so caught up with, you know, and fair enough, we're enjoying our connections with each other. But there are all these other voices, you know, there are the voices of the trees, you know, being stirred in the wind, and there are the voices of the birds, you know, quite literally there are the voices of the stream, which we cannot hear unless we slow down a little bit and unless we listen and we open ourselves in a way that I think my guess is I'm not alone, that a lot of the time we are just not in a state where we're able to be receptive to the rest of life. And I don't need to elaborate very much on the consequences of this state, this kind of very extreme dislocation between the human realm and the rest of nature. You know, to the extent that there's a little quote in a book I'll mention in a bit about which is about, in fact, if you're interested in this kind of thing, this book I so recommend, David Abrams, The Spell of the Sensuous. He's someone who studied traditional shamanism in Indonesia and Nepal, and he's a magician himself. He's a sleight of hand magician, so he was, you know, he's obviously someone who was able to enter into quite direct connection with all different kinds of people, not necessarily speaking their language and so on. But I think this book is about, well, you know, how did we become so divorced from these kind of experiences, you know, the stuff that the, you know, Wordsworth and friends were talking about. These things that we all know and that we value so much when we're in contact with that. That sense of a wider connection with something beyond ourselves. I mean, this is very Buddhist. You know, it's an antidote to the kind of everything revolves around me kind of thing that is the source of why we suffer so much, because we're disconnected. And there's a little quote, where is it? Yeah, he talks about being out in the wilds a lot and working with these shamans. And his definition is very interesting. The shaman is someone who normally they live outside of the village. They usually are somewhere a little bit in the wilds. There's usually a bit of a mystique around, which quite often he says they encourage that because they don't want to be too caught up with the village, because their role is something different. Their role is an intermediary with the living environment around. They act as an intermediary between the human world and the land and the inhabitants. And Abrahams is saying that that's the sort of definition of a shaman, is this deep and sustained connection with wild nature. You know, it's not about training in a particular sort of form or something. You know, it's very much on this experiential level or that is this kind of traditional role of the shaman. And they do have a role as a healer to the human community, but that's not their primary role. But their primary role is to balance, to keep the balance between the human world and the greater world beyond the human realm. see if I can find this quote. The traditional or tribal shaman, I came to discern, acts as an intermediary between the human community and the larger ecological field, ensuring that there is an appropriate flow of nourishment, not just from the landscape to the human inhabitants, but from the human community back to the local earth. By his constant rituals, trances, ecstasies and journeys, he ensures that the relation between human society and the larger society of beings is balanced and reciprocal, and that the village never takes more from the living land than it returns to it, not just materially but with prayers, propitiations and praise. The scale of a harvest or the size of a hunt are always negotiated between the tribal community and the natural world that it inhabits. To some extent, every adult in the community is engaged in this process of listening and attuning to the other presences that surround and influence daily life. But the shaman or sorcerer is the exemplary voyager in the intermediate realm between human and the more than human worlds, the primary strategist and negotiator in any dealings with the others. So I find that very interesting, and it led me on to a thing that I'm sort of thinking, well, who are our shamans? You know, who, I mean, I think it's very, very useful for us in the West to look at other cultures, traditional cultures, you know, in which people knew how to live sustainably, more simply, in ways that are not destructive in the way that our society, you know, very evidently is. So I think we have a lot to learn from, you know, from other indigenous cultures. And yeah, personally, I've very much enjoyed contact through Butterfield with people who've been into kind of, you know, druids and pagans and various people who, you know, who are exploring this territory in a very real way, you know. And the word shaman, incidentally, comes from the root shrama, which means religious exercise, and it's the same root as shramana, which is the word for Buddhist monk, the classic word for Buddhist monk. So they're you know, it's very much the same territory. Anyway, so there are various people. I think there are many, many people who are involved with the wild, with living simply, with trying to defend our forests and species, you know, this Abrams, he talks about the sort of casual way in which we are kind of currently wiping out all these different species, and that we could not possibly do that if we were not in this, it's because we are in this disconnected state. We just couldn't do what we are doing now if we were... if we hadn't got ourselves into this kind of dislocated situation. So I think that's what I'm looking at in this talk. Yeah, it's all sort of exploration. And obviously, you know, it's a big theme in the world, and there are many, many, many people who are approaching this subject from all sorts, and they need to be, and that's great. You know, people have their own way in. But anyway, I was thinking, so who are our shamans? You know, do we actually have to look to the Native American? You know, come on, surely there must be something in our culture that, you know, that must be there, you know, because, I mean, I don't want to kind of trash Western civilization. I think we, you know, we should celebrate what there is to be celebrated as well. Anyway, the answer came to me, actually, as soon as the question formed itself in my mind. Something came to me, and it was a memory of this poem by Mary Oliver, The Summer Day. So, I'll just read it. This is very well known. I'm sure many of you have heard it before. But I was thinking about Mary Oliver living out wherever it is she lives, doing her thing, and I thought, yep, she's a shaman. She's a shaman, all right. And she's connecting us in with that too. So the summer day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention. How to fall down into the grass. How to kneel in the grass. How to be idle and blessed. How to stroll through the fields. Which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last, and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? At this point, I'd like to give a little plug for Buddhafield Retreats. The Buddhafield Festival is a great event, and I love it dearly. But it's not perhaps the same opportunity for quietness and stillness that one might find elsewhere. And I think the opportunity to go on retreat in a natural environment is something very special, which I just hear over and over and over again, people telling me, this is just fantastic, you know, this is, I'd really love to see, you know, people come from other countries and they want to, you know, do the same thing there and they want to share something. The opportunity to be quiet and to be still, so I particularly would like to celebrate our total immersion retreats, our silent meditation retreats. I mean, there's all sorts of rich different retreats we can go on. But I think something about a human community living in nature and really quietening down this human chatter. The chatter, you know, there's no media. We're not chatting away with each other. And hopefully, the mental inner chatter begins to quieten down as well. I mean, not always, you know. It comes and goes. And we can begin to just have an experience of the trees, you know, the brook, and so on. These simple things, these ordinary, apparently ordinary things, which most of us, you know, just we're not in a space to be able to have that connection. And I think it's to do with this kind of this busyness, this chatteriness, this rush that is a big component of this disconnect that we very, very urgently need to address as a global human community. You know, we need to change, and we know that. So when I look back over my time in Buddhafield, actually, I think if I have to pick out one thing, one experience that I value, it's an experience of being with a beech tree on our land at Broadhembury and coming into deeper connection with the being or whatever. The being, yes, the being of that tree. I just want to mention another source of great inspiration at the moment. A guy called Maladoma Somme. He's a kind of African shaman, if you like. And he's it's an interesting story. How am I doing for time? Yeah. He was born in a West African village amongst the Dagara tribe. He was taken away at the age of 3 or 4 to go to school, Jesuit school, and he didn't go back to his village at all until he was 20. And so he's a very interesting person because he spans two utterly different cultures. He's had a kind of Western education, but his deep roots, you know, his early childhood and what he's been trying to sort of go back to in some sense, are from, you know, a West African tribal society that has totally different ideas about just about everything, you know. And one of the things in Buddhism that we're encouraged to do is to explore our own views, our own conditioning, to sort of question, you know, we have this thing, we're taught to see the world in particular ways, and we kind of think we're right because, you know, because that's what we've learned, and maybe we're surrounded by other people quite often who have similar views, so we all back each other up and so on. You come into contact with a different, completely different culture, something is very challenged by that, and in some ways the more different, the more useful maybe that is. So Maladoma Somei has very interesting things to say about our culture as a kind of, partly as an insider and partly as an outsider. So again, very strongly, if you're interested in this sort of stuff, recommend. He went back at the age of 20 to try and sort of reconnect with his village, and he was told by the elders that he needed to go through the initiation ritual. Process, it's a whole series of things which they normally do at 13 or 14, so he joined with the, you know, adolescent boys feeling a bit of a idiot, you know, sort of 20 year old and not really knowing the ropes and so on, and not really knowing their culture, not even knowing their language particularly, and not everyone survives these initiation rituals. They're very tough, and he's befriended by a boy who kind of helps him through, sort of pulls him through, really. But anyway, it's a very interesting story which he's written about. But the bit I want to talk about is his meeting with a particular tree. So the elders send him to go and look at this tree until he actually sees the tree. And, you know, to sort of report back to them and tell them, you know, what's happened. So he goes and sits in front of this tree, and he sat there, and it's like, okay, yeah, it's a tree, yeah, I've seen it, yeah, well, next. Can I go back and have my dinner now? and it's, no, they're obviously, they're waiting for something to happen with this tree, you know, and he just doesn't get it. And well, he's been educated to directly not to see that something like a tree isn't a being. You know, it's not. It's just material. You know, it's just stuff. You know, he's probably done his sort of chemistry and so on. Possibly, fortunately, I don't think I'm going to have time to go into the Newtonian, Cartesian background to these views. I've been trying to mug up on for weeks. But, you know, there's this whole thread in our culture which is, you know, mind-matter split, you know, and also the sort of human, you know, that we are somehow special because we've got this consciousness and everything else isn't really alive somehow. Not like we are anyway. Anyway, he's had all this conditioning and so, you know, he's just sat there and he doesn't really get what's supposed to be happening. And he sits there and it's about 100 degrees centigrade. And the elders are watching, you know, waiting. And all of his very, very painful story starts to come up. The fact that he's been taken away, you know, he's been taken away from his family. He feels utterly alienated, that he doesn't belong. He didn't belong at the Jesuit school. He doesn't belong back in the village. He goes into all this sort of massive process of anger and grief and bitterness and just everything. It all starts to, and frustration, and still nothing with this tree. And he stays there all day. He gets bitten by stung by a bee, and, you know, nothing happens. And he just has to go back to the camp feeling really humiliated. And the other boys in the tribe are sort of, they've done their tree bit and they're moving on to the next bit. So he comes back the next day, and he's kind of he's at his wit's end. That's probably an understatement. It's a very moving story, actually. Anyway, he suddenly starts to talk to the tree. And he said something like, "It's as if I suddenly realised it had a life of its own." And he starts pouring out all his troubles to the tree, and he starts blaming the tree for, you know, why he's having such a hard time at that particular moment. And then he realises, well, it's not the tree's fault, you know. And he starts talking to the tree in a different way and more respectfully. And it's like he kind of comes into communication with the essence that whatever this tree more deeply is. And then something happens. And, you know, let's go into the realm of, let's just don't be too literal about this. Let's go into that realm of poetic truth. But the tree suddenly looks up, and where the tree was, there is the figure of, it is a 7.5-foot figure of an intensely beautiful green woman. And she's not that she's got green skin. It's like she's green completely from the inside. She's like green light that's this kind of living energy. And somehow he gets himself to the goddess of the tree, and he's lying there in her lap. And he just has this experience of, you know, one of those experiences which, again, we've all had, those kind of, often it's just a fleeting moment of just sort of perfect union, perfect happiness. Everything is all right. And he feels that he has this experience of belonging, which is his big thing, that he doesn't belong. And so there's this kind of healing that takes place with this tree. And he's crying, and, you know, he's just having this huge sort of meltdown. And he experiences himself being held by the tree, like a baby being held by its mother. And he feels that he is completely loved and lovable. And anyway, there's a whole thing that happens, and in the end, she says she has to go, and he doesn't want her to go, but, you know, that's the end of that particular bit of the story. And anyway, he's kind of moved through that part of the initiation, and he's understood something about the life energy of this tree, and then the elders recognise that, and, you know, he's ready to move on. So I think this story, some people have heard it before a couple of times, I've told it a few times, it's kind of very deeply part of my myth at the moment, and I felt like I had my own just little mini tree experience, which was kind of, in essence, the same as what Maladoma Somme experienced. I was on it was the green retreat on the program. It ended up being, we called it the brown retreat, because it didn't just rain. I mean, it just belted down just day after day after day, and the sort of mud, and we all got flooded out. It was a very intense elemental experience. And I'd have to say, there's something about the actual discomfort of being in the elements at times that is part of this learning. I can't say why, but I know it is. There's something about going through something that is not comfortable and that is one cannot control. I think this rain sort of softened me up for this thing that happened with the tree. And anyway, we went to, we were doing this kind of shamanic stuff with Kuladitcha, and going off into the woods just to kind of be in a particular spot and just tune in with the land. And he suggested that we could try a classic sort of thing that people do is to enter into this communication through singing. And I like singing, so I thought, okay, I'm gonna sing to the tree. So I was lying in this kind of root in the rain with all my waterproofs on, lying in this sort of roots of this beech tree, absolutely beautiful. I mean, like those big, fantastic, beautiful beech trees along there. And so I started singing to the tree, and then something happened, and it was like I was singing the tree, or the tree was singing me. And it's kind of really weird music that kind of starts sort of high-ish and then it kind of gradually... It's not like our normal musical scales. And it didn't feel like it was coming from me. I just felt like it was an expression of something about this beech tree. And I can't quite remember what happened, but I guess I just had an experience of sort of whatever you call it, oneness, you know, with that tree. And I felt just like Maladoma Somme describes, you know, I felt like... I felt completely safe, like a baby being held by its mother, and just no part of me felt anxious or restless or, I mean, I was just totally happy there. And I felt loved. And I think, I don't want to make this a sentimental sort of thing, because it isn't. And I think, you know, nature red in tooth and claw, and it's terrifying and it's bigger than us and so on. But there is some aspect of the earth, perhaps, that is love. And I got that. That support that is always there if we tune, you know, this is what the Bodhisattva figure's about. You know, there's this energy in the universe that is, we call love, you know, and that is there within nature all the time, if we can somehow open to that. And I, after this experience with the beech tree, I felt absolutely wonderful for weeks after that. I'm usually slightly anxious, and that, it just all went. And I received a sort of healing, and I think the rain was part of that healing as well. The discomfort seems to be part of that sort of thing that happens. And Heath, who was he's our bushcraft guy, and he's a bit of a shaman, I reckon. He was talking about shape-shifting, and shape-shifting is basically to do with tuning in with the life of this particular creature, or tree in this case. And the tree I was lying on was it's next to a public bridleway, and a couple walked past, and they're about where Sophia is there, you know, really close. And they walked past and they looked straight through me. They didn't see me at all. I was just looking at them and having this lovely experience with this tree. And they didn't see me. It was really weird. And I told Heath, and he said, oh yes, very good, very good shape shifting. You know, you're doing well. So, yeah. That's... Okay, I knew I had too much material for this talk, and maybe, I don't know, maybe I'll do another one sometime. But I haven't really even got to the Buddhist stuff, sorry about that. It is there. Anyway, I think maybe I'll just... Is there anything really vital that I wanted to say? Yeah, well... There's probably at least another talk there, but anyway, I think I'll just leave them wanting more. That's always good, isn't it? I'd like to close with a poem, which is also on here. And, you know, if you're interested in this, I'd also really encourage you to read the stuff by Bhante Sangharakshita, where he talks about the elements and the Buddhist, you know, view of... this kind of area, but not now. But yeah, if you're interested. So this poem is by William Stafford, who's an American poet who's been, again, talking about the muse, you know, again a source of strong inspiration for me for maybe 10 years or something. I just never tire of looking through this book and finding more gems. A lot of his poems, they don't seem like anything at all when you first read them. You just think, oh, so what? A bit like the guy with the tree, you know, okay, yep, so. And then there's something in there that's deep. And I think, I don't know, I've been sort of figuring out why does this poem speak so much to me? And it's about a place, I mean, I've never been to America, so I've never been to the West Coast. I don't even... know that. It's about tuning in with a particular bit of land. But I think it's about what I'm trying to talk about here. It's about the state of connection and the state of being able to be with where you are and the more than human life that exists beyond oneself. And it's also about not being in that state. It's about what he calls the denial. And I guess we all experience that, and I suppose this is the sort of territory that I feel I've been exploring within Butterfield, sort of, you know. And it's not to say that just because I happen to be living in a tent by a stream for a month that I'm all tuned in and everything. I mean, that would be a totally false claim, but obviously it's in terms of conditions for certain things to arise, you know, it's a good conditions to be more connected. It's easier than it is in the city, without a doubt. So I have actually learned this, but I think I'm just going to read it because I messed it up last time I tried to recite it. So I'll leave you with this poem. Is this feeling about the West real? All their lives out here, some people know they live in a hemisphere beyond what Columbus discovered. These people look out and wonder, is it magic? Is it the oceans of air off the Pacific? You can't walk through it without wrapping a new piece of time around you. A readiness for a meadowlark. That brinkmanship a dawn can carry for lucky people all through the day. But if you don't get it, this bonus, you can go home full of denial and live out your years. Great waves can pass unnoticed outside your door. Stars can pound silently on the roof. Your tea kettle and cozy life inside can deny everything outside. Whole mountain ranges, history, the Holocaust, sainthood, crazy horse. Listen, something else hovers out here. Not colour, not outlines or depth. When air relieves distance by hazing far mountains, but some total feeling or other world, almost coming forward, like when a bell sounds and then leaves a whole countryside waiting. Thank you.